Welcome, everyone, to the Screamcast, episode 56. I am your host, Sean DeRager, and with me, as always, the lovely, the voluptuous, Brad Henderson.
I was supposed to quit after the last show.
I'm glad you haven't yet.
All right.
But I know it's just a matter of days.
Next week.
Today we are talking Starry Eyes, and we have a few special guests. I'm pretty excited about it. We have Kevin Kolsch and... Is it Kolsch? Kolsch? Kevin Kolsch. We have Kevin Kolsch and Dennis Widmeyer, as well as the amazing Travis Stevens.
I just say adorable.
Adorable's good. We wish him a speedy recovery because he was skateboarding the other day and he broke his wrist.
Yeah.
So, the interview was recorded prior to this, but since we recorded it, Starry Eyes has popped up on Netflix Instant, so now you have no excuse to watch Starry Eyes.
You do. Yeah, I mean, you might have to take care of your grandma.
Oh, God. Okay, when granny's asleep.
Okay, there we go.
When granny's asleep, you put her to bed, you put on Starry Eyes. Okay?
Yeah.
Stop making excuses. So we'll be talking to them.
You're racist and you are you ageism. Ageism. Yeah, ageism.
Granny
as well.
Goes to bed at 4, no, maybe 5 o'clock after her trip to Sizzler.
So yeah, in the black end of town, right? Sizzlers in the black end of town.
I almost spit up my coffee just now. Oh, God. Speaking of coffee, we are partnered up with Coffee Shop of Horrors. So if you go to coffeeshopofhorrors.com and you order some coffee, a sample pack would be nice if you are kind of new to them. And if you put in Screamcast and the coupon code, you get 10% off. Boom. Awesome. We're saving you money. That's about it. I'm excited to just get into the show because I want to get to the Starry Eyes portion. But we have our segment, What's on Your Doorstep, right now.
Holy cow, I almost forgot.
We'll get the door.
Pizza.
So Brad.
Yo, what's up?
What's on your doorstep? You know, one of our listeners had a great idea. I'll let you take it away because you were talking to them about it, right?
Oh, yeah. We had a listener. Was it Griddles? Mr. Griddles?
Mr. Griddles. Or Griddle Marks? I don't know.
Marks. Griddle okay. Marks. That's it. Griddle. Yeah. Oops.
Something like that.
But, yeah, no, Griddle Marks, he had just a good idea because, I mean, we sent out, you know, I said on Facebook and, you know, Twitter, and you know, I got a response on my personal account, the Screamcast account, my Facebook account, saying, "Hey, you know, we dig the new segment." So, no one said they didn't like it. Like I said, I think it's better because we can actually discuss and review more movies this way.
Yeah.
And instead of just having the show focused on one or two releases, we can do multiple releases, just many reviews. So it might actually be a little bit longer. But anyways, he had a good idea of putting the hashtag on Twitter, what's on your doorstep, so that way we can see, because we want to see what you guys have too, because, I mean, we're not the know-it-alls of Blu-rays and DVDs, just mainly because we don't keep up with it all, so yeah, just, you know, show us what you got, if you got something from the UK, anywhere, you know, anything new or old, it doesn't have to be new either, we're going to talk about older releases as well. It's just,
I mean, my wish list is ridiculous. I'm always kind of picking through my wish list and all of a sudden something.
Yeah. Cause I mean, there's like little things that come out. I have one that I had no idea that was on Blu-ray that I'm going to talk about in like 2 seconds.
Okay. So Brad, what's on your doorstep?
I have a lot. Are you okay?
Wow. Okay. Here we go.
Okay. I take a second. I need you to relax.
I'm relaxed.
But I got from Anchor Bay, I got a film about, because we talked about The Nightmare, which was about sleep paralysis. Well, Anchor Bay put out a movie called Echoes. It's on VOD, and it's going to be on Blu-ray available soon, about sleep paralysis. It was okay. It's well shot, very well shot, has a couple scary moments. It's got some cool acting. It's got a great setting. I wouldn't say go out and purchase it right away and maybe rent it when it comes down a little bit on Amazon. But yeah, it was a decent film. I also got from Olive Films Dangerously Close. Now this is a first for me. I had no idea this movie really existed, and I imagine that a lot of people don't either, because I don't hear people talking about it.
Hmm.
But this movie is by far one of my favorites of the year. It fucking blew my mind. It has, Dawn Stockwell. It has Carrie Lowell. It has Tom Matthews that plays Tommy Jarvis in, you know, the Friday the 13th films. It has Miguel Nunez that plays in Friday the 13th Part 5. If you know who he is, he also is in that Kicking It Old School movie or whatever. And Juana Man, if you remember that. Karen Lohr. But it's directed by Albert. How does he say his last name?
Pune. I always say Pune. I don't know. I could be saying it wrong.
Albert Pune. Well, anyways, he directed it, which is kind of bizarre because his way of showing how a movie pans out is always just very odd. I mean, he's directed like, you know, he's known for Omega Doom, Cyborg,
Sword of the Sorcerer.
He did the Nemesis. I don't think he did the first Nemesis, but he did like Nemesis 3, 4, 5,000, whatever.
He's brought in for like odd sequels every now and then too. Yeah.
I mean, he did one of my favorites, Vicious Lips. He did Radioactive Dreams. It needs a DVD or Blu-ray release. But anyways, he worked with Full Moon a little bit, so he has like he almost has that really cheap Full Moon feel, but yeah. This is not like that at all. It's like if you took Class of 1984 and Surviving the Game and kind of mixed them together, that's what it is. It's just about a bunch of fucking rich kids that have this game that they play where they have somebody run in the woods and they go after them with weapons. And it's in high school, and they do this for fun, and they got their eye on one of the smart kids who isn't rich because they need him because he's smart. And he has, like, a punk friend, and he hangs out with the punkers and everything. And, you know, they're always standing up for him saying, you know, fuck those guys. But it gets super fucking intense, and it's just really fucking good. Great soundtrack, amazing cinematography. So that's a must-buy for everybody.
Cool.
I'm just going to say, just go out and buy it.
Let me mark that down.
Olive Films just released it.
They just released a shit ton of movies. Like, they even had like 15 releases in one day or something. Well, it was crazy.
They do releases every 2 weeks. Jeez. And it's usually about like 5 or 10.
Yeah.
Got another one that I had no idea that was on Blu-ray. Congo. I think I might have heard about it, but I forgot about it. Congo's on Blu-ray, just to let everybody know. Paramount put it out. If you guys don't remember Congo, it is fucking silly, and it's like a pastime. It was one of those movies that I saw in theaters, and I was blown away by it. And then I saw it when I was older. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? But I just kind of it's almost like I learned to love it.
Huh?
You know? Are you a fan of Congo?
I haven't seen it in years, and there's a really great How Did This Get Made podcast where they talk about Congo. It's hilarious. They rip it to shreds, and I've been wanting to see it, and I think the Blu-ray is really cheap, so I've been meaning to just pick it up.
Yeah, I picked this up for $11.99 at Movie Stop, and I'm super excited. I put it on just for a little bit just to see the transfer. The transfer's, you know, very, very decent. I forgot how much practical effects are in this movie.
That's like the gold. Like
I was skipping by like through a few things, just seeing, you know, kind of the monkey, because they have that one sequence. I say monkeys, they're not monkeys or apes, but that one sequence where all like the apes come out.
Uh-huh.
Dude, it's all people in suits and shit. Like, it's crazy. Like, it looks really good. You know, I think you got to respect it for that, because this movie, it feels like this is a Brian Trenchard Smith movie sometimes, that Brian Smith makes the biggest movies for like $5. Mm. And that's kind of what that feels like. So Frank Marshall directed it. So I would, if you are a fan of Congo, I know there's like a hidden group of people that love Congo. Another one by Olive Films I recently – this is directed by Val Guest. He directed a bunch of horror films. He talked about, you know, the Quatermass experiment. This is a drama thriller he directed. It's called The Weapon. It's super interesting and just, like, very well-directed and intense. You don't really think of movies from 1950 to be intense sometimes for me. Like – I don't know, because they didn't have the – they relied a lot – let me take that back. The movies are intense. It's just that we are so kind of drowned out with scores now to make – like if you take the score out of the movie's not that intense, but the score makes the movie more intense.
Yeah.
In the 50s and 60s, I've been going through a lot of these releases from Olive Films and older films now, because it's kind of where I fall through that I don't – my knowledge isn't that, you know, powerful. They don't rely on scores. They rely entirely on acting and storyline.
Right.
And this movie is about a little – two little boys that find a gun that's kind of embedded into a brick, and they're playing through some rubble. And one of them claims it, and they're like, no, give it to me, give it to me. And they end up – the one ends up shooting the other kid and killing him.
Jeez.
And so he's on the run from the cops, but they do a ballistics report and find out the gun was used in a killing that was unsolved of this, like, policeman. So the kid's on the run. The criminal is actually a well-known guy, and he goes after the kid too, because if that gun is retrieved – they're going to be able to trace it back to him. All they have is the ballistics report from the bullet. So it gets really intense what this guy does in order to capture this kid. So the kid's on the run. He's scared. The cops are after him. The mother gets involved. The guy is after the kid. It's just – I'm not going to give away the kind of the secret towards the end. But, dude, it gets super intense. It's so weird. Like, you don't – like, without a score making you feel the way you do watching this movie. But I think that's a lot of Val Guest because, you know, he throws in some horror elements too, which I was surprised. But to me, that guy can basically direct anything. He's done comedies, dramas, horror, whatever.
Sweet.
I finally watched Muck.
Oh, God.
Everybody fucking hates this movie. I understand why. it's one of the worst things I've seen in a while. I usually don't say that because I want people to watch everything and I don't want to make people's minds up. So this is probably very, very rare you'll hear me say it. I mean, I don't like some movies, but I'll never turn people away. But Muck is fucking garbage. It's nothing but a guy who... I don't call movies misogynist because I'm not one of those people, but this movie's fucking misogynist as fuck. Like, literally, it's just nothing but women jumping and running around, getting their tits sprayed with blood, close up, like, on jiggling when they're screaming, women just modeling for no apparent reason, the monsters rip clothes off of the women but don't rape them, but they don't rip the clothes off of the men. It's just fucking gross. Like, I love titties, I love breasts, I love pretty girls, and this has all of it. But it's just so, like, blatantly stupid.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I enjoy – I want some substance with my boobs. You know, I want a reason why I'm seeing a woman's, you know, breast – you know, it's not campy at all. Like, you know, Prada 3D, woman running around, close up the boobs, no big deal. But it's campy. It's meant to do that. It's fine.
Yeah, same with that – what's that older Roger Corman flick? Where the monsters come out of the water.
Oh, like Humanoids of the Deep?
Yeah, Humanoids of the Deep. Like, yeah, that almost gets there. You know, there's a few scenes, but...
Yeah. I mean, there's a certain finesse to these movies in order to get away with it. Like, this movie is just mean. Like, it's very mean. It's not meant to be a comedy. The dialogue is piss poor. The only thing I enjoyed about it, and I highly doubt this is going to work out for the director... This is a trilogy.
Oh, God.
But this is the second movie in the trilogy. So when it starts, you are jumped into a bunch of people who have already died. Everybody's bloodied up and hurting, and they're running from something. And it ends with just a scene saying, oh my God, what is that? And then it ends and the credits roll.
Oh man.
Because this is the second, like, I kind of, I dig that setup.
Huh. That's so the first movie will come later. Apparently.
Yeah, I'm guessing that the first movie will be next or will be last. I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know, man.
But there's a lot of questions of, like, what these things are, where do they come from, how did these kids get there. So I enjoyed that part, but there's also a really weak week. Like, if you're a filmmaker and you are going to trash Wes Craven, like, I understand Wes Craven is not up to par like he used to be, but, man, that man's responsible for Nightmare on Elm Street. I mean, Deadly Friend, People Under the Stairs. He's a fucking great filmmaker. They take a jab at him through dialogue in here that's pretty sickening. The place where they're going is called Wes Craven. And the guy's on the phone. He's like, oh, man, your guys are what, Wes Craven? That place used to be so cool and fun, but now it's just dried up and stupid.
Oh, wow.
And it's just like he keeps going on about how awful Wes Craven this place is. You know, injunction of... they're talking about the director.
Yeah, huh. That's not subtle at all.
And if you're a shitty filmmaker, you better make... I mean, if you're going to say that, you better make damn well sure you're revolutionizing the horror genre. But you're not Steve Walsh. And it's funny because the very first reviews that popped out of this, I remember Freddie Squires looked it up. Or John Squires, Freddie Fingers.
Yeah.
All the good reviews came from the premiere. The premiere was at the Playboy Mansion.
Hmm.
That's where all the good reviews came out. This holds like a 2.3 on IMDb. I hope it gets down to a 1.
I thought John Squires didn't like the movie, though.
No, he didn't.
Right.
But he wanted to know where those good reviews were coming from.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yeah, he...
And they were coming from the people that attended the Playboy Mansion party.
Well, of course.
So,
That's one movie that I saw people who, you know, who dig exploitation cinema. And it's not like... people who don't like exploitation cinema are trashing this. It's like this is people who know what they're looking for. They understand the genre. They understand the exploitation factors of it, and they're even sickened by it, which is crazy.
I'm happy about the horror community because, I mean, the horror community is kind of putting this down. Even though, like, it's like there's a bunch of boobs, the girls are super pretty, but no, I reject this movie.
Huh.
Yeah, like, there's 100%.
There's like one site.
I hardly ever say no to anything. Yeah. Like, I fucking love Serbian film, and that thing pushes limits like a motherfucker. Ugh. But this movie is worse, like, just to watch.
Hmm.
To see these. It's just, interesting. I don't know. It just fucking sucks.
It's a fine line. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next, coming up or released next week is Biodome by Oliver.
Yes.
All of them.
Oh, my God.
I know everybody, like... you know, everybody hates Pauly Shore, which he made. He made a documentary about that.
This is one of his best movies, man. I'm a fan of Biodome.
I actually didn't enjoy Biodome when I was younger. It was all right. I'm a big fan of Son in Law and Encino Man. So I recently rewatched Biodome. Dude, it's pretty fucking good. Like, I was laughing, and that doesn't really happen too much.
Yeah, you hate comedies.
Yeah, I hate comedies, but the soundtrack is what really did it for me. It's got a killer soundtrack. I mean, it's got Reverend Horton Heat. It's got a bunch of, it's got that one, is it called, it's not Dio, because it's Ronnie James Dio, but a band, it starts with a D, I forget it, but they had a hit song, and it plays
Dawkin.
Dawkin. No.
I'm
going to
start listing off band names that start with D. Dream Theater.
But anyways, no, it's a pretty fun movie. It's Pauly Shore's Pauly Shore. He acts like himself, but it's actually pretty funny. You know, so if you haven't seen it or you didn't like it when you were younger, give it another shot. Transfer is okay. They're just all the films uses HD masters, which sucks because I would really like some special features on this.
Yeah,
like a fucking commentary with the cast and crew now.
Very fun.
Like, I think that would be painfully awkward, also hilarious, you know, at the same time, maybe throw a soundtrack in there, because, man, that soundtrack's really good.
Yeah.
I mean, the 90s was all about the soundtracks.
Yeah.
Now we don't give a fuck. So, shape up.
I'm waiting for these old films to drop in price, because right now it's like $19.99. I'm sorry, but I like Biodome, but I'm not paying $19.99 for a bare-bones Blu-ray of Biodome.
Yeah, there's stuff usually...
you can get the DVD for like $2.
Yeah. I know people, there was a TV show called Fear Clinic that Robert Hall directed. Robert Hall is known for Laid to Rest, the Chrome Skull movies, which are amazing, by the way. Great practical effects. He's a wonderful practical effects artist.
Oh, yeah.
Anyways, they made a feature of Fear Clinic with Fiona Dourif, who is Brad Dourif's daughter. She was in the recent, Child's Play movie, The mm-hmm. Curse of Chucky. She is super cute.
Yeah.
She looks like her dad.
Oh, no.
So it's kind of funny because you see him a lot, especially when she gets angry. You can see that, that Brad Dourif face, and then you see, kind of Chucky come out a little bit. So it was... It's a little interesting to see.
I knew a girl like that one time back in the days when I was single. One of my friends' sister was super cute, but she looked like my friend. So I was like, yeah, I'm never going to date her because it would be like I'm making out with my friend. That'd be weird.
That'd be all right. Corey Taylor from Slipknot is in this too, which was a little odd, but it works. He's all right. But it's basically it's just like the TV show. A doctor's crazy. He has a way to pull out your fears. It's a little boring, sadly enough. But it's very similar to the show. If you ever watched the Fear Clinic show, it was like 6 episodes.
Is it Robert Englund in it?
He's in it too. But yeah, it's got some great special effects, but it just lacks in the keeping you interested department. Man, I got a lot, dude. I got the Alan Quatermain in The Lost City of Gold, the sequel to that other movie that these people did.
What was that other one? I've seen the first one. It's cheap Indiana Jones ripoff, but...
Yeah. No, this is exactly... Because I recently just watched Raiders of the Lost Ark for the first time. So watching this, now, I'm like, oh, my God. What's the first movie called?
Which one did you watch?
King Solomon's Mines?
Yeah, King Solomon's Mines, and then there's Lost City of Gold.
Okay, I've never seen King Solomon's Mines.
It's probably the same. I mean, I haven't. I would imagine it's the same as Lost City of Gold.
I watched this, and this is just a blatant ripoff, and it's not even that fun. I think people like it because it's so cheesy and campy. I enjoy just watching Sharon Stone in HD. but as far as somebody that's coming fresh to this, I didn't really care for it. It's just a blatant ripoff. It's not good at all. Sorry, fans.
Yeah. Sharon Stone's in both of them, right?
Yeah, and so is Richard Chamberlain. It is what it is.
Yeah, so. For what they are. I mean, these are... I would never recommend these to someone who – to watch for the – I don't know. Yeah, it's one of those things that kind of relies a little bit on nostalgia of the time, you know. But they're goofy as hell. King Solomon's Mines is super goofy.
Yeah, this one is really, really goofy. Sharon Stone's the worst. It was funny because they – in the documentary that hopefully is coming out on DVD Blu-ray soon, I saw it at a festival – it's basically the story of Canon Films. It's called Electric Boogaloo. And they discuss this movie kind of in depth a little bit about the problems and Sharon Stone being a complete idiot on set, apparently. So it's fun. I can't wait to watch that again because now I watched the movie. That's what brought it up is I was watching the documentary and I'm like, oh shit, all these movies, they talk about Ninja and all that stuff. So, it's a fun documentary. Definitely watch it whenever it comes out.
It's great that all these movies are coming out to be more a little more readily available with that documentary coming out. I can't wait for that documentary.
Yeah, so I'm just gonna stop. I'll let you go because I got a few others, but they're not really worth talking about.
Okay, if you want to, you can hold them over till next week if you want.
Yeah, I figured that because I actually watched a lot of stuff recently.
You watched it. I mean, that was my problem this week. I didn't have a lot of time to get to my to-watch pile. And, of course, that's what these are. I mean, I have movies showing up, but, I got to watch them first. But I placed an order for three Grindhouse releasing movies after us talking about, you know, Massacre Mafia Style. And I finally got The Beyond in the mail, which is a great package. It's, you know, they Grindhouse releasing's packaging and everything is a lot of fun. They're trying to do like a, you know, Criterion level type stuff, you know. And so I got The Beyond. I haven't watched it yet, but I immediately ordered, as we were doing the podcast last week, I immediately ordered Gone with the Pope, and then I also ordered Corruption, and then I ordered Cannibal Holocaust, which I'm a bit scared to start Cannibal Holocaust, but so I did this order for Grindhouse releasing because I'm totally on board with them now, and I got to Gone with the Pope, and you know that's such a weird movie, man. I wished I would have seen it, you know, in time for us to discuss with Massacre Mafia Style, because it's a perfect, it goes along with that movie perfectly. It would be a great double feature, I think, if you start. And I think Massacre Mafia Style was his first movie, and then he started filming Gone with the Pope, and then that never saw a release, is what I'm trying to, watching the special features is what I think. It was all within like a year of each other, you know. But Gone with the Pope, man, I didn't know really know what to expect. I was expecting, like, you know, kind of a violent gangster flick, but it's not. It's kind of, there's little bouts of violence here and there. But it's like these aged gangsters who are out of prison. They go on a boat trip, and then while on the boat trip, Duke Mitchell's character decides they're going to kidnap the Pope and then try to hold the world ransom, all the Catholics ransom, and ask from a dollar per Catholic. Which, that's just a small little sliver of the story. It never really is the full focus of the movie. It's just a weird movie narratively.
And it's Oscar Mafia style, though, in a way.
Yeah. It goes right in line with that film. Oscar Mafia Style, I think, is a little more notorious because of the violence, I think, in it. But this one has just some weird things, like, I don't know. You kind of see who Duke Mitchell was, you know. Like, there's a scene with like a very large woman, I guess, was a prostitute, and it just goes on and on. And it's supposed to be funny, but after a while, you just kind of feel bad. It's. You remember that scene?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're talking about.
You kind of just go, this is going on way too long. And speaking of exploitation, you know what I mean? It's just like, I don't know. You just feel your heart kind of goes out to the poor woman and what she had to go through for that scene. But it's really weird. So I got that. And if you're to have this with Massacre Mafia Style, I think it's great. To get on its own, I think if people buy this on their own, it's going to be a bit of a what the fuck. You know, like, what is this film?
I think it pairs perfectly up with Massacre Mafia Style.
It does, and if you watch the special features and learn a little more about Duke Mitchell and everything, it works perfectly. And you know, the story of them, how they brought this, you know, the movie was I think it was done, but it never got a release, and then Grindhouse Releasing stepping in to, you know, do the color correction and to really restore the print. Is pretty a pretty amazing story, and then in 2010 it finally got its theatrical debut, which is just that alone makes this movie kind of worth checking out, you got to give it to Grindhouse Releasing, you know, those guys for really, you know, putting the money into this film, because it's I want more of Duke Mitchell now, but sadly there's not too much more of him, you know, especially that age. Like, he did those two movies and then he died, you know, so it's, you know, some great special features, a lot of great interviews on this disc, and it's worth checking out. But like I said, on its own, like, you would have to pair this with Massacre Mafia Style for it to really...
Watching it alone, you might kill yourself.
But it's
definitely worth it. If you're into cinema like that, you'll dig it for sure.
Yeah, and it's funny because the editors they interview the editors of the movie, and one of the guys, I forget who it was. I mean, these are all like people involved with this film went on to, you know, get nominated for Academy Awards and win Academy Awards. And one of the editors said that, you know, at the time he knew the movie was crap. You know, he was just, it was a job, and he's editing it, and he was just like, wow, this movie is a piece of shit. It's just pretty great, you know, with these interviews and how, you know, how honest everyone is, you know. But of course, the some movies move past being bad, just kind of being notorious, and this is definitely one of them.
So, yeah.
Anyway, great release. Grindhouse Releasing Man. They're killing it. What's the next movie they have coming out? Cannibal Ferro.
Yeah.
So that's up for pre-order, and they said they were doing it exclusively Diabolik for the pre-order, but Amazon has it, so too. So.
Well, Brian will be happy.
Yes, I will too, because I'll get it on the release day.
Yeah, I don't know why you guys are doing that through Diabolik. There are only two people, so it's like.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, Diabolik's great. I think for kind of off the wall stuff, for you know, overseas movies, they get a lot of great things in, a lot of great exploitation flicks in. You know, for anything like that, and if the price is right, I'll use Diabolik. But you know, anyway, move along. Next up, here we go. I have a thing where if I see a Dolph Lundgren movie, I'll pretty much just buy it, even his newer crappy movies. I recently got his new zombies, his new Dolph Lundgren with robots versus zombies. It's a movie called Battle of the Damned. Have you seen this?
I saw part of it.
Now, I was expecting a full-on shit fest. I was not expecting anything good, but it was. I think I got it for like $3, so the price was right. And my Dolph Lundgren collection is continuing to grow. Him and Van Damme. I just every time I see a movie for cheap, I'll buy it. But it was actually surprisingly good.
You buy anything that's cheap.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if it's worthwhile, if it's fun, if there's a fun factor to it. This movie I was expecting to maybe watch and then just turn around and sell right away. But it's actually kind of a fun movie. The robot effects are, you know, they're on the lines with, you know, the Battlestar Galactica TV series, the newest one. Those robot CG effects, like, they're okay, but you could, you know, they're CG, but they're not horrible, if that makes any sense. But it's a, you know, typical Dolph Lundgren sci-fi flick. The zombie, him versus zombies.
You say typical, like how many has he done?
Dude, he's done so many, but some are awful. This is actually, you can tell the director wasn't just phoning it in. Like he wrote and directed it. Let me see if I can find the director here. And you know, all the acting is pretty great. Christopher Hatton is the director's name. And he's, you know, he's kind of done kind of cheap, you know, kind of cheap stuff like but I think he's written a lot of things, but I think this is the first one he's directed. But like I said, you know, if you ever see it streaming on Netflix or whatever and you're bored one night and I would say give it a watch, because it's the acting's pretty great. Like this could have been totally horrible, but it was actually kind of enjoyable. I dug it, and Dolph Lundgren's you know, he's pretty great in it. He's a badass. So that's all I got to say about it. Battle of the Damned. You know.
I think Dolph Lundgren's movies he directs are pretty good, which is like Command Performance.
Oh,
and
yeah, that was great.
Yeah, those are some of my favorites.
Command Performance is awesome.
Yeah,
but that was one that I was expecting to be a total crap fest too, and I really really dug it.
The only weird part is that his daughter is in that, and she's used like as kind of a like those terrorists like. Want to get with her,
oh.
But like 12. Ugh, it's super awkward.
Awkward.
But anyways, I mean, it's his choice, of course.
Next up, I got around to watching the Roger Corman produced Avalanche. This was from 1978, and this is Kino Lorber, or Kino put this out. This was in conjunction with Scorpion. And stars Robert Forster's in it, Mia Farrow's in it, and it's not good. Like, it's not a good film at all.
How about even a fun factor? No fun factor?
The fun... I mean, it takes forever to get to the disaster. When the disaster happens, there's a lot of unintentional humor. When stuff's going down, it's pretty slow moving.
They're kind of like Titanic.
Yeah, Exactly.
I laugh in Titanic.
There's some great stuff. Like, this is low budget filmmaking, and there's one scene where someone's supposed to be falling from a ski lift to their death, and you see them falling, and clearly right in on the bottom third of the screen, you see everyone holding the giant trampoline.
Ooh.
And you see him falling towards the trampoline, and as soon as he is about to hit the trampoline, they cut to him hitting the ground.
Rock Hudson's in that.
Yeah, Rock Hudson. There's that stuff. I mean, you know, it's bottom rung 70s disaster flick. It's Roger Corman seeing that these movies were selling and for a quick buck was, you know, got something made and put out with a fantastic poster, of course. You know, I was expecting it to be better, it's, you know, it's for what it is. I guess it could be fun, but I don't know. I don't know what I was expecting, but it gets humorous for sure. But it goes on a little long, so I don't know. But it looks all right, and I don't know. Anyway, moving along to something better. I also got the Blue Underground. They do a lot of horror stuff, but they also have some great kind of Italian cinema, some great Westerns, and then they have some action flicks. And I got Machine Gun McCain.
Oh, yeah.
And this was one that I'd been wanting to see for quite some time. It has Peter Falk in it, which got me thinking. It's like I don't own enough Peter Falk movies, because that guy's awesome, and he has to be like 30 in this movie, but he talks just like Columbo. Like he seems older than he is in this movie, but it's young Peter Falk, but he's talking like Columbo the whole movie, you know?
Oh, that's a good Columbo impersonation.
Yeah, I used to watch Columbo all the time. So this is starring John Cassavetes and Peter Falk, and it's about a guy who, I believe he gets out of prison, and then he gets hired for a job to
rob a casino.
Will you let me? Will you let me talk? Son of a bitch! I'm actually getting this plot crossed with Gone with the Pope in my mind. it's turning into a really weird movie in my head. I was gonna say he gets out of prison and he has to assassinate 7 people. Oh wait a minute, that's not this movie. He gets hired to rob a casino, and shit goes down.
Yep.
But I like this kind of a low-key gangster flick. John Cassavetes is great as kind of this tortured guy who, you know, has to do this job. Peter Falk is awesome, and it's great. It's 1969, and it's like, you know, that you don't get movies like this anymore. You know, you don't get. There's just a grittiness to these films that because of the time and when they're filmed and budgets, they had to kind of just run and gun and get things done. It's a great movie. It's, you know, you have to kind of let the movie build and wait for some things. But I really did this flick. The transfer's great. Blue Underground. I really like that they don't just stick to horror. I like the movies that they choose outside that genre. And this is a good one to pick up if you haven't seen it. What have you seen it? Do you like it?
Yeah, no, I'm a fan of that one. Yes.
Yeah. Pretty great. All right, I got a few more here. When we were talking about Death Ring, when you brought it up, I grabbed the DVD.
Isn't that my pick of the week? You can't steal that.
I'm just saying that I watched it. 1992. I grabbed the DVD, and I'm just saying that it's a movie.
Whoa.
Dude, Don Swayze got like the bad Swayze genes.
Whoa.
It's like someone took Patrick Swayze's face and like squished it and then hit it with a frying pan.
That's fucked up, dude.
Maybe it's the hair that kind of makes his face look all just disproportionate, but and he takes forever to show up too. But when he shows up, you're like, whoa, there's a Swayze. It's unreal. But, for what it is, the movie's fun.
Great.
Good old Mike Norris. Billy Drago. But who are the other guys? Chad McQueen. Anyway, because of you, I grabbed the DVD and I watched it. And I had fun with it for what it was.
I'm glad, because it's a good movie. Don't giggle.
I wouldn't say it's a good movie, but it's a fun movie. If that makes any, you know. Anyway, all right.
Sorry.
Moving along. I grabbed the movie Black Rain. I'd never seen it before. It's a really early Ridley Scott movie.
Ooh.
Starring Michael Douglas and Andy Garcia. And this thing, I don't know why it took me so long to watch, and I'm glad that I bought it.
You watching Blue Crush?
Blue Crush is on my to-watch pile, and I love that movie, so shut up. Black Rain is fantastic. Like that, it's, you know, there's movies that I enjoy that I know are bad, then there's great movies. Black Rain's a great movie. I love the setting in Japan. Dude, Andy Garcia's character is great. A lot of fun. Probably one of my favorite performances of his. Michael Douglas is just badass in this. I love his sarcasm and his I don't give a shit attitude. You know, of these 80s movies always have some cop or detective that doesn't give a crap and goes against all the rules, and he's playing that character in spades. Like he's great. The direction is great. The like I said, the setting in Japan is awesome, and it doesn't stray from the violence. Like there's some like stuff goes down, and it's a pretty violent flick. And I like it when movies will kind of go for it in not over the top, but in you know when stuff happens, you're like, oh,
like Sylvester Stallone over the top.
Like what?
Sylvester Stallone over the top.
Yeah, that's over the top. Like the newest Rambo is that's crazy. But
no, I'm talking about over the top.
Oh, and over the top. Well, over the top is awesome.
And yeah, I know. Completely over the top. But Cobra.
Cobra's amazing. Anyway, Black Rain, if you haven't seen it, I don't know why this took me so long. I don't know why it took me so long to see this movie. I don't know if it's considered one of his, you know, everyone that I talk to loves this movie. I don't know why it kind of slipped past me. But if you haven't given it a chance, it's one of Ridley Scott's better movies. And he's just... You kind of, with all of his newer movies, you're wishing Ridley Scott would get back to this, you know, style of filmmaking, because lately he's just been just overblown epic mode, and he doesn't know how to rein himself in, or the studios don't even know how to rein him in. They try, but I don't know. But
he's like a loose cannon.
Yeah, like Michael Douglas. Yeah. Anyway, Black Rain. Awesome, and I think the Blu-ray is pretty cheap. That's why I finally grabbed it. I think it was a pretty decent price.
Yeah, but if you have HD DVD player, pick it up on there because the transfer is better.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Noted. All right, and finally, I
have them both.
I recently received the UK Blu-ray of the movie Rogue, the big giant crocodile alligator movie.
Well, there's a big difference between crocodiles and alligators.
I know. I think it's an alligator.
It's the same thing as I said, monkey and ape. I quickly...
Oh, it's it says crocodile in the synopsis.
Right, so because crocodiles get big. Alligators necessarily don't unless you put them in a sewer and then, you know, they grow.
Right, exactly. This is directed by Greg McLean. And has he done any other films? Because this is like...
Yeah, Wolf Creek.
Oh, yeah, Wolf Creek. Yeah, okay. Relax. I'm not perfect. I still need to get to Wolf Creek, too. I haven't seen that yet, so... I've only seen one other of his... I've only seen Wolf Creek that he's directed, so relax.
Okay.
So, Rogue is pretty great, and... The CG on the crocodile is okay. It's not the greatest. And in HD, you can definitely notice the CG-ness of it in some spots. But he does a good job of kind of hiding the crocodile. And the last scene is when you kind of notice it more. But I think he does it well. It could definitely go into, you know, sci-fi movie territory, like the TV channel sci-fi. But he does a good job of really doing it well. He handles it well. And the reason I got the UK Blu-ray was the Blu-ray out. I don't know if it's a Canadian Blu-ray over here or not, or if there's an actual U.S. release. I'm not 100% sure.
It's Dimension.
It's bare bones, I believe. And the DVD had a really great documentary, and I kind of, you know, I grabbed the UK Blu-ray just because I knew for sure it had these special features, and it was super cheap, and it's all region. So I grabbed the UK version. I could be wrong. I mean, I don't know. I from what I looked into, I thought that the...
I have the Blu-ray of this one. Is I don't it remember bare bones? Any special features on it.
Okay, yeah. So the UK ports over all the DVD special features, and there's like a 45-minute documentary that's really, really great. And I remember when I saw this on DVD, I immediately watched the documentary, and I really had fun with it. So... Anyway, if you're gonna grab this for the first time, if you don't have the DVD, and if you want the documentary, grab the UK Blu-ray.
So, yep. Or you can watch Blackwater, which is a much better, you know, Gator movie.
It's okay. Blackwater's okay. I liked Rogue more. I don't know. I liked Rogue more. What can I say?
You're cute.
I don't know. It's personal preference, man. I think Blackwater. I don't know. I Rogue has more of an epic feel, and you know me, man. I friggin'
like well, things yeah, because Blackwater feels more real.
Well, yeah, yeah. I need to. Blackwater is one of those movies that I saw. It was okay, but I saw it right after Rogue, and I had more fun with Rogue. So Blackwater is one of those movies I need to kind of revisit.
Same thing as I prefer The Reef over, you know, that other open water movie.
Well, The Reef's awesome. Reef's way better than open water. I'll give you that for sure. Go check out The Reef, everybody. By the
way, he loves animals.
Who does?
The director. He directed Blackwater and The Reef.
Oh, okay. The Reef's great. It's a step above.
He has another one called The Jungle.
Okay. Cool. I'm not saying Blackwater's bad. It's at the time I enjoyed Rogue more.
No, you just said it sucked. So
I didn't
fine.
Say it sucked. Rewind it and listen. Anyway, we have a fantastic interview to get to here. I was really excited to be able to talk to these guys. Of course, Kevin Kolsch, Dennis Widmeyer, and Travis Stevens. We will be talking Starry Eyes.
Welcome to Big Taters. My name is Sarah. Can I start you guys off with an order of our Freedom Tots?
We got all these people, all our friends. They're just sitting around trying to figure out what to do, trying to figure out how to make something.
I thought you were avoiding me.
Why would you think that?
Because I stole your role.
What's going on with you lately?
So hard. Every week it's a new class, a new audition.
Hopefully you'll see something in me.
I know I'd be great for this.
We'll be in touch.
Hello, Sarah. We'd like to see you again. And Sarah, this will be different.
Sarah, relax yourself.
Sarah, if you can't fully let yourself go, how can you ever transform into something?
I'm dying!
No. You're being reborn.
Your face would be on the poster on a wall in a lobby of a movie theater. A theater with a marquee.
Kill your old life, Sarah. Bury it in the earth. Join us in the skies.
That's me. I'm your girl. I will do whatever it takes for this role.
All right, well, I'm very excited about today's guests. We've been talking about the movie Starry Eyes for quite some time, I feel like. We've been trying
every
to...
Every episode
we plug it whenever we can. But finally, schedules worked out, so we have Travis Stevens with us.
Hello, hello.
The producer. We also have the writers and directors, Kevin Kolsch and Dennis Widmeyer. And if I butcher any names, please let me know.
Did pretty good there, man.
All right. Well, thanks, guys, for coming on the show and talking with us. We were we've been excited about this movie for quite some time, and I finally just saw it for the first time, so I actually stayed spoiler-free up till the night I watched it, which was ridiculous, considering the back of the Blu-ray cover once I looked at it after I watched it.
Yeah.
I warned you. I know.
I avoided looking at it.
Just don't flip it over.
Yeah, I got it in the mail, and I flip it over, and I'm like, what the fuck? Like, I mean, I know it's not a direct spoiler, but I was like, oh, that's a pretty big moment. Like, yeah. You know. But that's creative control under that doesn't really matter.
You get to experience people twice now.
Well, my first question is going to be, like, how far are we going to go into this conversation?
Because
a film that is really, really, really difficult to kind of to talk about in a way. Because it's easy to allude to what the story is. So it's up to you guys if you want to not spoil the movie, but be a little bit spoilery, I guess.
Well, it depends. Have people seen the back of the Blu-ray yet or not?
Probably. I think it's safe to assume.
I think we're all pretty good at about not spoiling it and talking around it. And I think at some point, if we want to get into a spoiler conversation, we can just kind of split the thing in half and have the first half be non-spoilery and the second half be a little more in-depth, you know, and just warn people before we do that.
Cool.
Yeah, totally.
Cool. Or we could just talk about a different movie.
No.
We could talk about Summer's Moon.
Derailing the conversation.
The albatross.
Summer's Moon. It's going to be hard to talk about. I haven't seen it yet, but
have you seen the Blu-ray?
I've been trying to stay spoiler free with this as long as I could. I wasn't able to catch it. I don't really father of three, so I don't really get out too much.
You should watch it with your kids. Did you watch it with your kids?
No.
It's a good one.
And I know this is playing festivals, and. I'm not exactly sure about a theatrical release, but it's one of those movies that a lot of my circle of friends have been talking about. So it was great to finally sit down and watch it. The Blu-ray looks great. And what I liked about it the most was I like the kind of, there's a blend of like, subtle humor throughout some of the film, especially with dealing with the LA scene, the hipster scene and things like that, you know, how everyone's on their phones and Instagram and especially the stuff with Big Taters, I thought was hilarious. But what was great about how it was handled was any other directors or writers would probably, or even like a studio if they were kind of trying to run the film, or they would play that up for a lot of laughs. Those Big Tater scenes with Pat Healy and. But what I liked was it was like subversive. It was more realistic because I worked in the food industry, and I related to the ridiculousness of, you know, trying to promote the restaurant and everything, and selling that product. But also, you know, all the humor that can come along with it. But I thought that element was handled very well, and as the movie goes on further, we, you know, spiral more into more kind of darker territory. But I liked the balance, I think, with the subversive humor. Is that something intentionally you guys tried to do, or was that something that kind of actors brought with them? Like, how does that, you know, from script to the screen, like, how did that translate?
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely intentional. I mean, we had always meant the film to be partly satire, but, you know, it was also like everywhere along the way, from working with the actors, from the script to working with the actors to even editing it, was just kind of keeping the balance, like how much you want in the movie, or how, you know, like, and keeping it tonally even and not tipping too far in one direction. And like you were saying about the humor being subtle, it was one because it is also a horror movie, and you didn't want to like the tone to be all over the place. Mm-hmm. But also, I just think as far as humor goes, that like I think sometimes when people make these things played more for laughs, like you say, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like not treating your audience as if they get it enough. Like, I mean, the thing is, when you walk into a lot of these theme restaurants, I look at them and I go, this place is ridiculous. You know, like nobody's going there, like, you know, like, and then a lot of times if you see it in a movie, you got some guy that's like, hey, welcome to blah, blah, blah. You know, he's got some, like, he's over the top guy, and you're like, you know, it's like, I don't think you need to, like, play it that much. I think, like, these places are ridiculous in and of themselves, and it's just kind of like, you know, like, and we kind of like trusted people like us that watched the movie are going to go like, yeah, this place is pretty, you know, like as far as the restaurant goes, this place is pretty ridiculous without like having to like go like wink, wink, you know.
Right.
And depressing too. I mean, like the whole idea behind Dictators was just giving her a very, you know, almost kind of like demeaning job. Mm-hmm. Where she also has to, quote, act. You know what I'm saying? So it's like she can't – you have to like juxtapose the two of them off each other. You know, so at first we were like maybe she works as like at like a store where she has to wear some crazy costume or like a mascot or stand on the sidewalk and wave to people. Something that basically where you're, quote, acting but you're not really, really acting. So it's like, hey, you're pretty and you can act, so can you go sing this tater tot song and wear this crazy outfit, you know, and then go in there and do the things you really want to do. So it really was to – off balance her dream. It was like, okay, this is what she's chasing, and this is the ground, the reality of what she really has to do. Mm-hmm. Where these women are all probably actors, you know. Pat Healy even says that a lot of actresses come through here with dreams, you know.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they're being handed tasks to do where they have to sing songs and put on a personality, and it's almost like acting, you know. And it makes that drive to chase that dream even more desperate because you see what she has to go home to every day and you know, and go to work. So it had to really be depressing as well. Yeah. Ridiculous.
And it's desperate for her. Like, the thing is also, it's like she could – it's what puts the ticking clock there for Sarah, because she looks at everybody else and her roommate says like, oh, yeah, I paid your rent, because her roommate kind of probably isn't acting as much anymore. She's accepted her day job because she needs to do it to pay the rent. And like she goes to work and all these other waitresses that probably, like Dennis was saying, were actors at one time. It's kind of like, oh, well, you know what? Here I get to perform a song, and like that's kind of like performing, and I get paid for it. It pays the rent, you know, and she's seeing all these other people that are kind of like, you know,
accepting
what they need to do in life, or that, hey, I still get to perform a little bit here. And it's kind of like she has this ticking clock that, like, you know, it's kind of, this could be me, all these other people, you know, like.
And then a thing that does happen once you get the actors involved is, and part of their process is sort of really trying to complete the character in stuff that's not, you know, on screen or in the script, because that character, you know, has a life outside of those scenes that we happen to see. And when you have those conversations with the actor, it helps really sort of draw connections and stuff that you might not have, you know, might not have been immediately apparent. And so I think in those conversations with Pat, you know, and sort of grounding that character, the idea of, hey, you know, there's a interesting correlation between Big Taters being his dream and, you know, Sarah chasing her dream. And then you're sort of like, oh, wow, okay, so now we're getting some layers into this stuff. And I think throughout the process when you're working with people that are and you can really communicate clearly about sort of what your themes and what the tone is, that process can add sort of can help sort of bring out some of these facets, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a fun part of the process.
Travis, when did you get involved with the producing Starry Eyes? Do you guys have a relationship with past films?
No, I mean, it was on Twitter. Dennis was – I had followed him on Twitter for a while, and he was wondering if anybody was watching a UFC fight. And I think it was the first or second Frankie Edgar versus Gray Maynard fight. And I was like, yeah, we're down at Big Wang's. And I was there with Evan Katz and his brother, Cheap Thrills. And Dennis came and we probably spent – I don't know if it was a year or whatever, but we were just friends just watching fights. And then he was like, yeah, me and my directing partners back in New York are thinking about doing this Kickstarter movie, this $50,000 movie. You know, you want to get involved. And it was one of those things where – you know, the whole Kickstarter crowdfunding thing was so daunting to me because yeah. I'd never done it and I just wanted to know how it worked. And Dennis and Kevin are really smart guys, and they had lined up a couple of sort of incentives that seemed like, hey, we could get some attention, because Dennis runs Chuck Palahniuk's social media business, and sort of like, oh, well, Chuck's going to get behind the film, and we got, you know, they got Jay Shah to do some of the teaser artwork. And I was like, all right, this is going to be cool. And it's a $50,000 movie. We'll just go out and we'll have fun. And so then we have our first meetings, and they're like, yeah, and we want to shoot on film. And I was like, wait, what? this is crazy. What are you talking about? And we're going to need more money. And so as we start, you know, sort of putting the pieces together of what this movie looks like, we're like, we're going to need a little bit more money. All right, if we're going to need more money, we're going to need some more cast and stuff like that to sort of help raise the profile of it. So we started pulling in, you know, cast that you know, we were friends with or had worked with in the past. And Dennis and Kev had done a lot of work finding Alex and who plays Sarah, and the producer and the casting director. So they had already done some work, and then we just sort of brought in other people. And it just sort of started growing. And the beauty of it was, in our minds, we were going to make this very small movie. But as this process went along and more people got interested in it, and we started, you know, really working on the script and working with the actors, the thing just sort of grew bigger in all the right ways. Like, it wasn't a sort of like, hey, we can get more money. And you know, it was more like, you know, the script started sort of getting deeper, and there was all these great ideas and stuff. And when they brought on Adam Bricker, the DP, sort of the visual approach sort of warranted, you know, a slicker sort of package there. And it just all sort of grew really beautifully. Is that your memory, Dennis and Kevin, or was it a simpler version than that?
Except for that part where you said we didn't just go, hey, we need more money. Exactly like that.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. But yeah, everything is. I don't think we ever wanted to shoot on film. I think. But yeah, he's right though. It really came together kind of organically. I think it was. We looked at the makeup too. It was like, man, she's going to require like 5 hours of special effects makeup every day. Mm. You know, we need the time to really do this right. But it was very organic. It was sort of like the train started to leave the station and everyone just started jumping on it. And then it was just off nice. The races.
And then we looked like one of those trains coming up to the States from like Nicaragua, where everybody's riding on the roofs. And
or Slumdog Millionaire or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And then we looked out the train. There were some bandits riding up on horses coming to rob the train. And
nice. Just keep pushing this.
And then Chris Evans was working his way from the caboose to the engine. It all sort of grew from there.
And we were reading all about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid yesterday, train robbery. So we're in a weird train robbery metaphor right now.
Does that mean you guys are working on a train robbery movie in the future?
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Kevin and I actually wrote a Western that had a guy that was like a sniper that worked for the railroad, and like just wronged by like the sheriff, and they like try to kill him, you know, and he gets revenge, and the whole thing was, you know, the myth of this guy that like they call him the Choo Choo Man, you know, and like he comes back kind of from the dead, and like you hear the train coming, and they all know he's coming, like so the train was sort of like a rooted part of his like mystique, I guess, or his backstory.
That's pretty badass, right? The Choo Choo Man.
Choo Choo Man.
Yeah, man. Man. I love Westerns. I don't know. People always say to stay away. You know, not a lot of Westerns get made, but I love Westerns. I don't know.
And we get the best title too. It's called "And Hell Came With Him." Sunday. Someday we'll get to make that movie.
Johnny Cash playing over the trailer.
There you go.
Coming together. Yeah. Kevin and Dennis, you guys, I love hearing about director, like, partners, you know, a director team, as opposed to just one person kind of running the whole show.
Right.
Is that something intentionally you guys were looking for, or did that happen just over time with you guys, you guys known each other?
Yeah, it definitely just happened kind of like fatefully, you know, like we knew each other sort of through like high school, middle school. We, you know, we grew up very close to each other. We kind of knew people through extended circles of friends. So I was always aware of Kevin, you know, I'm sure he probably knew me a little bit, but we didn't really like, we weren't like close friends. We didn't hang out a lot. And I was probably like 19, he was 21, maybe mid 90s, I guess. So we're dating ourselves here. We're not young anymore. We were at a party and we were just hanging out at this buddy of ours' place, and Kevin was there. And I don't know if this is the party, Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong, but we had Pink Floyd playing, right? Works.
Yeah, no, I don't think this was that.
Animals, it wasn't that? Okay. Kevin got up there and like just knew all the words, and he was like like mad Mater D. It was just crazy, you know? I was like, who the hell is this guy? And I didn't realize he was that theatrical and kind of like a, you know, I always knew him as like this metalhead from like middle school that like, you know, were all black, you know, had a backwards baseball cap on, and I was like, I'm scared of this guy, you know? And then I saw him at this party, I was like, this guy's pretty cool, you know? And so a buddy of ours was like, hey, yeah, you and Kevin would hit it off. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, well, he writes screenplays. Dennis, you write screenplays too. I was like, yeah, I do. And this is the first time ever someone ever introduced me to someone like that, because this is the suburbs of Long Island, New York. It wasn't some trendy party in Hollywood. So it was kind of odd to be like match made based on our writing, you know? Usually it's like, hey, you like to drink, I like to drink, let's go drink. And instead it was like, you guys both write. And our friend, to his credit, kind of like matched us, you know? And then like we both snuck away from the party and went back to Kevin's place, and like he showed me a script he was working on. I'm like, oh, I got something kind of like that. I shared it with him, and then before you know it, it was like, hey, let's write together. So instead of going out and partying every weekend, we'll bring the party to us. Like, you'll bring your word processor to my parents' basement, and I'll bring my word processor downstairs. We'll get some beer. We'll put some music on. We'll just write, you know? And then that very quickly became us getting distracted in a good way and saying, why are we writing separate screenplays in the same room? Let's try to write something together. You know, so we started writing screenplays kind of in a very haphazard, fun, kind of enthusiastic way, and banged out a whole bunch of those, and then just got better and better at it. And before you knew it, we were like, our visions were evolving and kind of like organically coming together. And it was sort of just expected that when we started directing movies, we would direct together, because we creatively, we were already working together through most of the 90s. Mm-hmm. So when we finally started directing together, it wasn't like a big decision. Like, we're going to direct it together, right? We're good with this. It was sort of just like, we both knew that was going to be the case, because everything we were working on and writing together, we were already living in that world, a partnership. You know, so our visions were able to come up together. So we always get this question where I think people assume that two writers, directors working together are going to butt heads a lot, and they're going to be very individualistic, and their visions are not going to merge. And we always tell people that we've been doing this for so long that our visions came up together. You know, so we were into the same things, the same themes kind of light us up. So, you know, it's not always easy, but for the most part, though, it's very, you know, it's very just natural for us.
Yeah, they really do a good job of just sort of like bouncing ideas off each other, you know, and sort of sharpening ideas, because they can talk about it. Because a lot of times you're sort of working through something in your head, and you need that sounding board to sort of, you know, somebody to bounce it off of. And I think you guys have a great sort of ability to take A and then B, and then C ends up being really perfect, you know?
Yeah. You're kind of forced to kind of like really like work the problem through and kind of like argue over it. So by the time you get to set, you've talked out every angle. And sometimes when you're like, you know, like one guy kind of just working on it, you know, and you're only really dealing that with producers and stuff, you have a tendency to kind of just, you know, go, no, me, this is the best idea. Right. And you have someone kind of holding you accountable, and vice versa, you know, you go through a whole workshop process before it even gets to a person like Travis. So by the time Travis hears it, we've kind of really worked it through, you know, and then he'll bring some perspective to it we didn't even think of. And now it's like, you know, it really gets worked before you just do it, you know, and that's the way it should be. It should be very collaborative.
Yeah, and what a lot of people don't know is that when they're actually on set, they have like a Penn and Teller thing where Kevin doesn't say anything, and everybody is terrified of him the entire shoot.
Whispers in my ear.
Listen, Travis, I was always told you shouldn't talk with your mouth full, and me and you have those Oreos in our mouth the whole time.
It was very awkward. Yeah.
Or should I say chocolate sandwich cookies? I think we had Oreos on day one, and by day two we were on like the generic chocolate sandwich cookie.
It went downhill.
We kept the wrapper from day one, so people didn't realize it.
Get nostalgic.
Yeah.
You got to keep that budget down. You can't overspend.
Yeah. We had generic Coke on day two.
Yeah, by day two, okay. Honeymoon's over. Let's get real.
Well, you guys are mentioning the cast in Starry Eyes, and you know, it's crazy because you guys did need an actress to carry this whole film, and you needed an actress to kind of, when the oh shit moment happens, you lean forward and say, oh shit, you know? And Alex Esso, she did great, you know, kind of bringing the character the arc all the way through, you know, into the movie. Did you guys find her through casting calls, or? I'm horrible.
Yeah, well,
names.
That's the one thing I want to ask with the casting, is that there's two actors and two characters in this movie that I absolutely love, and that's obviously the lead and Mark Center's character.
Nice.
With I have a question on that for sure. Is that Well, it's two parts. Is that number one, did Mark bring that himself, or was that kind of intentional, having that Hollywood type-esque casting kind of director doing that? Or was that something that, you know, you kind of had maybe a slim idea for him to kind of be an asshole, but Mark Center like took it to a new level?
He's fantastic. Yeah,
that's basically it. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, he's written in the script to be a little bizarre, and he's obviously he's obviously shooting her down and like being rude, and that was what we had in the script, and Mark kind of brought that uniqueness to it.
Yeah.
He went kind of like, this is my experience. He based it off of like casting directors that he knew or people that he knew in the Hollywood industry. And he was just kind of like, you know, so he just took like what was in the script and he filtered it through his own experience and people he knew and said, this is what I think the type of character that you were writing, this is the way that they are in this world, in this industry.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like, he brought his own approach and we were like, you know, we all were like watching him during like the read through, going like, "Oh, that's great!" You know, like he brought so much to that.
He got the cold humor of it. You know, he definitely played it straight, but it is a little bizarre and ridiculous. I mean, these actors go on auditions that sometimes are very just like, you know,
yeah,
you know, very cold. You know, and we definitely wanted to play that up a lot. You know, so that when she finally gets it, even though she shouldn't be trusting it, the warning signs are on the walls. They've treated her like such crap up to that point that the minute that they start paying attention to her, she's already willing to do anything for them, you know, because they were so difficult to impress, you know?
He's got this smarm to him that's just like, it's just, you know, it's a smile, but you just, it just is such a greasy smile where you're just like, oh, this is not a good person.
And the thing about Mark, too, is that it's the type of thing where that is a barometer for the movie of whether or not people are going to, like, really go with it. Like, we'd be watching this movie at film festivals, and, like, you know, it's pretty bleak. You know, there's a girl crying and pulling her hair out in the first 5 minutes. And then she's at a party, and everyone's being hostile to her. And then she gets to that audition, and this kind of, like, you know, elevated character starts talking and doing the stuff. And, like, you start to hear people in the audience kind of laughing. And it's good. It's, like, mm-hmm. a good laugh. It's like, oh, I could decompress now and realize that they're having a little fun here. They're being a little satirical. And so we have to really, like, give a round of applause to Mark, because that's the character that lets you know you're allowed to really enjoy this movie. It's going to be a brutal film, but you know, we're also kind of having some fun here.
Yeah.
So that's like a litmus test for whether or not the film is going to really work for people. So whenever that scene comes on and people start really kind of going with it, there's always like a big sense of relief, like, oh, okay, they get what we're doing here.
Yeah.
You know?
It's cool. It's funny that you mentioned that, because I do, I kind of host like an all day, like marathons at my place, have a bunch of people over. And that was one film that I immediately after I saw it, I was like, yeah, I got to put it in there.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like, it was funny because that whole casting sequence, I was just staring at everybody to see their reactions, to see how they would grasp it. Because it is like when I very first saw the film, it caught me off guard. But then one thing I did like about it, and going back to in the beginning with Sean about the whole Taters thing, is that the underlying like tone to the film is very real at the same time. Like the struggling actress in, you know, kind of like a Hooters thing, or, you know, I don't know if there is Mojo's on the East Coast or whatever, but, you know, it's kind of the same thing, you know, I call them titty restaurants.
Right.
You know, and it's just like, you know, you have a lot of people in that industry, and especially, I mean, how many people work in the food industry trying to struggle in L.A., New York, wherever they're trying to get their break from, even in entertainment industry to, you know, even singers and everything, just dealing with that. So I like the realism and how it kind of went in depth a little bit, but it also didn't show like her interacting with customers, mostly just based on her life dealing with her everyday issues. And I did enjoy that. So I liked how you guys molded that for sure. And, you know, caught some realism to kind of this bizarre story.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, even the interview with, what I brought this up was Mark Center, even like demeaning her and degrading her in a way. You know, just felt real. Like, even though I've never been in that, well, I actually have been in a casting call before, but, you know, just watching him do that, it, like, it's funny, but it's also, there's a big sense of realism to it too, where, you know, those people are in power and they're on a power trip. So they can basically say, do whatever they want in order to, you know, do whatever they want. And
yeah.
I just thought that was, I thought that was really well crafted. And the other question I had is, you know, Sean kind of asked it too. Did you have her do a reading like that? Because my main question is that if she did you actually have her do a casting call like sequence in the casting call where she kind of loses her shit?
Yes.
Because that's a big crucial part to the movie. So I wondered if, you know, you had one of the biggest sequences done in a casting call of her doing a casting call.
Yeah. Well, on the second audition, like on the first audition, she came in, we did some scenes and, just, you know, to see if we could find somebody that had, you know, the acting chops. And she came in, we really liked her, thought she was good. And it's like, but a big part of, you know, this movie is that you're willing to go there. This movie goes in a lot of places and like, it's a low budget where we had a tight schedule. So it's like, you don't really have time to be like with people that don't understand the vision or aren't on board with what you're trying to do or that are going, why am I doing this? Or I'm on the floor. Or you really want me to, you know, put my head like that, you know, like, so it's kind of like one of the almost as important as having somebody that could give the performance was somebody that was game for doing these things and that understood the material and that was excited by it and challenged by it. And Alex, you know, she had seen all the movies that we were influenced by and that we brought up and that we referenced. And she went like, oh yeah, I love Possession. And we'd go like, oh wow. You know, like she knows all these movies. She loves them. She was like, I can't wait to do this. She was like, I get to do the full spectrum of acting. I get to use every tool in my actor's toolkit. And she was really excited by it. And we were like, you know, so she was really game to do this. And that was a very important thing. And before we obviously had that conversation with her, we had a second audition and we had done, we had asked her to kind of go like, yeah, like, you know, if you could do this scene where you flip out for a little bit, just because, that was a big part of this character. And also the willingness of an actress to go ahead and, you know, be uninhibited like that and to give that performance was, you know, a big part of casting this role. So, yeah, on the second audition, we did ask her to kind of let loose. And,
yeah, it's on the Blu-ray, too. You can actually see her doing
it. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome, yeah. Now, when you said you were influenced by other films, I mean, obviously this has, you know, these Starry Eyes is the prime example of the films that I love that are throwback but don't claim to be, you know, kind of that whole, because, I mean, it's a big thing now that's coming back. And I think you can easily make a movie in vain of the things that you love without, you know, slopping some, you know, wear and tear on the film digitally. And, you know, having a bunch of old actors as cameos. I think that's a weak process. With Starry Eyes, you don't do that at all. It hits with the music 100%, mm-hmm. as well as just the whole theme and tone to the film just feels like one of the biggest things that I noticed, and I don't know if this was a big influence at all or influence at all, technically, but was The Sentinel. Just because I kept feeling that vibe like throughout the film where, you know, something terrible is about to happen, but you just kind of don't know when it will. And it's just a big sense of dread.
Yeah. We didn't talk about The Sentinel a lot, but in hindsight, I think we kind of realized that they had a lot in common. Yeah. To the point where I think we looked into like, who has the remake rights to that film? Like, there's more there to explore.
And also, I just want to say real quick about it being about throwback films like you were talking about and you were saying about like, oh, digitally scratching the film up. And like, it's just funny. Like, you know, the way I look at that is I see films today that go like, oh, we're an exploitation movie, so let's digitally scratch it up.
Yeah.
Where we didn't even shoot on film, but all these other films, they're only on film because they're only scratched up on the film because it's the same print that's been circled around and shown a bunch of times. The people that made those movies probably would love to have their films digitally cleaned up, you know, like,
exactly.
And that's the way I always felt. Like I used to, you know, you'd see some old film that wasn't ever released on DVD or Blu-ray and you were watching it on some like bootleg VHS and it was like recorded off of some old scratched up print and you were seeing it that way. And it was like, being a fan of that stuff, it's like anytime I would always hear that, like, hey, you know what? That film finally got picked up for like a Blu-ray release and they're going to like clean it up and everything. And I was like, I would always get excited by that. I'd go like, I can't wait to see that old like exploitation film that I only saw in like such generation loss quality. Like, looking like it was originally shot and meant to be, you know, like it's like those movies weren't shot with scratches all around them, you know, like they just became that way through like the print being shown over and over again. And, you know, like, so I don't think that like throwback to another movie is necessarily like to go like, let's shoot digitally and make it look like it's a scratched piece of film. You know, I think that's kind of like
self-aware.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's too self-aware and it's kind of like focusing on the wrong things. Because like I said, those people back that were making those exploitation movies would probably love to see cleaned up versions of their film, the way that it looked when they first shot it, you know, like,
yeah.
And so, I think another thing, I mean, not that your comment was saying this, but I think it's easy when you watch a film to sort of look for reference points and things to compare to. So, you know, it's like the throwback idea. It's like, oh, you know, it's got this sort of old school synth score. It's, you know, got elements from this and that. But hopefully when you're making the film, and certainly with Starry Eyes and some of the other movies we made, it's we're not setting out to emulate something that came before. You know, you're looking to create a new piece of work mm-hmm. that works on its own terms. And like a musician might be in the recording studio and decide on the instrumentation because, you know, they heard an old record, you might be like, oh yeah, we should get a mandolin on this song. You're not actually going into the recording process being like, hey, we want to, you know, make this album sound like, you know, Three Dog Night or something. And so like, especially with Starry Eyes, it's like, yeah, there are sort of touchstones, reference points, but not from an emulation standpoint, simply from a, hey, here's how they did it in this movie that seemed effective. And is there something we can learn from that? You know, not trying to recreate it or anything like that, you know?
Well, yeah. That's what I've appreciated about all the movies that I've seen that you've produced, Travis, is, you know, Big Ass Spider is definitely, you know, influenced by, you know, all those old giant monster movies. American Muscle has like an exploitation feel to it. You know what I mean? Like a 70s exploitation. And when you kind of get that feeling, but it's still new, you know, it's not, trying to emulate anything from the 70s, but it's underlying. You can feel where everyone's going, everyone's coming from, but you're not going there. You're not winking to the audience or anything. And same thing with what I get from like the trailers for We Are Still Here. It totally takes me to like kind of the old Fulci movies or anything from the 80s. You know, I get that feeling, but from the poster and everything, but I know that going in, you know, it's not going to be, oh, this is going to be just some, you know, reimagining of some 80s. It's not going to feel 80s if that makes any sense. You know, yeah. I think it's really cool. And I'm drawn to movies like that. I mean, Drive is another good example of other types of other movies that have done this. So I think it's great. I think, I mean, I feel like we're really like 2000, the after 2010, I feel like we really have a lot of really cool movies doing that, you know, before it was, you know, we had Grindhouse and Hobo with a Shotgun and things like that, that are just straight up trying to emulate Grindhouse. But I feel like after that, it's been exploitation, you know, but not trying to emulate.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was this little wave of people who are like, hey, look, here's our influences. We loved 80 horror slasher film. And everybody's like, you know, because horror had gotten so sort of commercial, you know, people sort of responded to that. Like, oh, I like that. I like that movie, therefore I like this. But it's like right now we're in this time and this was actually, you know, probably the most creatively rewarding thing from Starry Eyes, but we're in this period where people are using genre films to talk about bigger sort of themes and issues. And it's like, you know, Starry Eyes, yeah, on the surface, it's a movie about, you know, a girl who makes a deal with the devil, basically, you know, but really, what are we talking about? We're talking about ambition, just what a monster that can be. And that's the fun, not, hey, look, our movie looks like this movie, or, you know, it sounds like this movie. It's like the fun is talking about those themes and finding ways to say something, you know, and that's why I think like people respond to it, because they get the subtext to this movie, and it, you know, that's the horror, you know, that human ambition, you know.
Well, because we've all been there. We all have that drive and that ambition, and we've all I think we've all had that point. You know what I mean? That crossroads where you know I can basically sell my soul here and just do whatever it takes to get where I want to be, or I can take this other way that's may take more work. To get where I'm going, and we've all had that. We've all had to, or will have that at some point, Brad hasn't yet, but
it's Dennis not funny, and Kevin Sean.
Had a there was a different directing partner they had at one point, and Dennis killed him before he and Kevin hooked up.
Roy.
No, I like what you said, Travis, on that, because it's true. Because I mean, there was a time, even though I dig Tarantino's films, we still have that a lot from Tarantino, where it's like, oh, I like this and this. Look what I can do, and put all these into my movies. It's more fun when you sit back and then you think about it, and then you come to the realization, like, oh, that could have been influenced by this, or it's just that feel, not watching the movie and realizing that they're borrowing certain things from other films. It's fun to sit back and think about it and kind of not make comparisons per se, but kind of see where the filmmakers were coming from, or obviously what they were influenced by.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So yeah, on that too, I think that it's funny you brought up Tarantino. I would say, though, I would think that he's doing what we were saying we liked. He does take this, that, and that, and that. But I think his things always do feel new, something new.
He recreates it a little bit. He definitely puts his own spin on there.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I just want to say one thing about Westerns. We have three fucking awesome Westerns coming out.
Oh, really?
We got Tarantino's Western.
Oh, yeah.
That apparently is shooting right now and just totally epic from the location managers who we've spoken to. Then you have Ty West's Western.
Oh, shit.
With Travolta and Ethan Hawke and a dog, a little revenge Western. And then you have Bone Tomahawk, which is Kurt Russell versus some sort of supernatural Indian tribe.
Nice. So
we
are going to fucking rock out this awesome Westerns.
I'm excited.
So I'm guessing that means that we're going to get Dennis and Kevin's Western too. That's what it's in.
I
think so. There may be a meeting after this podcast.
He's coming. Choo-choo man is coming.
I wanted to talk to you guys about the music, because in the commentary you guys mentioned that you had, you were going to go along the more kind of orchestral score, and you had some temp orchestral tracks that you were cutting to, and then it evolved into more electronic score. What happened with that?
Well, Travis wanted to get a mandolin and do some Three Dog Night, apparently.
Okay.
That's accurate. Yeah, we were, editing the film, and, it was just going off traditional stuff that we liked, a lot of, Clint Mansell, really good guys, but I don't know. The film needed some sort of momentum and kind of pulse to it.
Yeah.
And so Jay Shaw, who did the poster for us, he recommended Jonathan Snipes. We had seen Moon 237. We were like, okay, that's pretty synthy. I don't know if we hear that, though. So as a test, we just said, let's start dropping some of his tracks from Room 237 into our film as temp tracks instead of going orchestral. And right away, the film... I was sitting there with Travis. We kind of looked at each other and started giggling. And it was like the film kind of came alive in a way. We said, this is interesting. Okay, let's pursue this. So we reached out. We met Jonathan for coffee right in the area over here. And I think I personally assumed he was like so busy he was turning down jobs, because, his score for Room 237 was just so good. And I felt like, all right, someone's had to have discovered this guy already. And he was actually really looking to do a feature film, and he had not been approached yet. And we were lucky. We got to him, and he saw a rough cut of the film, and it completely fell within his wheelhouse. And it was the exact type of movie he really wanted to work on. And so it happened very quickly. And he came on board, and we met with him. And the thing we really talked about was that we didn't want to just do a big, loud wall of sound ambient, soundscapey type of score, which is effective in a lot of movies. You know, we have these big rushing noises and stuff. We said we want something that has a melody to it, that you could just listen to the score on its own and sort of hear the story of the film. You know, you could hear Sarah's theme kind of running through it, you know, throughout the entire arc of the music. And he really got that.
Being corrupted as it goes along, just like she is. Like, that was one of the big breakthroughs, is sort of like identifying a little theme for her and then starting to fuck with it as it goes along.
Yeah, and I think he spent like 3 weeks to a month on the score, not even. And he admitted that I think two of those weeks were spent just trying to come up with that melody, that jingle, you know? And like, that kind of runs throughout the entire movie, if you hear it. And like Travis said, in the beginning, it's very innocent and it's done with a music box and it's very kind of like sweet. And then it slowly gets more and more corrupted as she gets corrupted herself. And then it weaves into the cult theme. And at the end, they've kind of merged and become one. And you're like, wow, okay, that's the music sort of told a story there. Yeah. And that you think that everyone would do that nowadays, but I don't hear enough of that in horror scores.
Yeah, so. A lot of people, they kind of go for more of the ambient sounds and things.
You would expect, and especially a film like this.
Yeah,
but it didn't do that at all.
I love soundtracks and scores with a theme, you know, whether it's per character or a running theme throughout the film. I always kind of gravitate towards that, and you know, I want to be like, I want to go out of a. It's weird. I judge movies on many levels, but part of it is, you know, the score. Like, did I walk out of the theater or get done watching it, going, I want to go find that score, you know? And it doesn't happen to me as much, hasn't as much until lately, where there's a lot of. I feel like we're coming back to more. It's more classical scoring, but a little bit different. Not as much orchestral, a lot of synth and things like that. But there's a lot more melody, I think, coming back into film scores, which is great, which I love.
Yeah, it's personality.
Yeah,
and I don't know why it was, but I mean, we like not just with Dennis and Kev, but on other filmmakers too. Like, we sit there and we go, "What the fuck happened to horror movie scores where it just feels arbitrary?" Mm-hmm. Sort of what's going on in the form of it. Sure, it builds and you know, has stings and stuff like that. But it really felt like it could have been to any other movie. Like, the score itself doesn't have the DNA of the actual picture in it. And now it feels like we're getting back to – I don't know if it's just the filmmakers that are working right now or some of the composers getting into the game who are – you know, not burnt out yet, but it feels like we're starting to get scores that are fully unique, but also really capture sort of the personality of the film. And, you know, the record labels that are putting them out, like Death Waltz and Mondo and Waxwork, you know, I think are doing a really good job of sort of highlighting these ones that when you hear that song, you see that film, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I would have never, you know, I own the soundtrack to Chopping Mall, and it's like I never thought I would ever own that, you know, that soundtrack on vinyl, no less. But it's, I feel like, you know, there's seeing that, seeing music come back, especially with, you know, people are buying old movie soundtracks on vinyl, which that's ridiculous to me. I never thought that I would see that happen, and we're seeing it happen, you know, with these companies, and you know, it's just really fun. And even I'm hearing It Follows. I haven't checked out the soundtrack yet because I want to see the movie first. But that's getting that is getting a good buzz with that soundtrack. It's just pretty cool to see.
Yeah, and we love it. It's great. And then you have more stuff to listen to.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you said, like, you never thought you'd want to go buy the vinyl for a Shopping Mall. And it's like, you know, suddenly the things become like things you want to covet and own.
Oh, yeah.
And they're good to listen to. So it's the best of ever, you know, all the worlds.
Yeah, it takes you back to, you know, that feeling that you got, you know, because with It Follows, that opening sequence and that song that plays very, very loudly and gives you goosebumps. And within 3 minutes, the hair is raising on your, you know, body because you're so frightened by what you're seeing on screen, as well as just that piercing noise that is happening. You know, it's just, it's a great feeling to go back and watch that and kind of relive, you know, just audio wise, just hearing that. Are you guys having sex in a chair?
No, this damn chair is so squeaky. My office chair, and I've sprayed it with WD-40. I can't find where it's squeaky. And like, I want to throw it out. It's so squeaky. That's me leaning back right now.
I'll edit it in post.
Sorry, yeah, I'm trying not to move on it too much. But
It's a haunted chair.
Yep.
How much of the a lot of the themes with Star Eyes a big character is kind of the L.A. scene with acting scene and you go to a party and everyone has a script, everyone's working on a movie, everyone's trying to be an actor. Was there anything based on personal experience with you guys, or was this was there any scene at all that was something that possibly could have happened to you guys?
Well, here's a crazy story that we tell. Years ago, Dennis and I had a script. We were trying to make a film, and we were trying to raise some money for it, and we were going about it all wrong. We were doing that whole thing. Like, we'd read, Christine Michon's book, Shooting to Kill, and she talked about how, sometimes when you're producing, you're chasing actors and you're chasing money at the same time, and you tell the financiers, this person's attached, and you tell the actors, yeah, we got money, and, everything falls into place, and we were like, yeah, we're going to make that happen. But, it's not like we weren't operating at her level. The actors we were chasing were not the people, the stars that she's talking about or whatever. So, it just was this film that we were trying to make happen for years, and it was, but we were still holding auditions and meeting with investors and trying to make it all fall into place. And we kind of auditioned this one guy, and turned out that he was from Brazil, and he had this accent, and he kind of really couldn't lose it, but he was a nice guy, and we had actually let him read the script, and he was he loved it, and he was praising it, and we were oh, he's so nice, we feel bad. We told him, look, you're not right for the role, but maybe we'll give you a smaller role or whatever. And then he started calling all the time and saying, hey, you promised me a role. And we're we didn't make the movie yet, we didn't get the money yet, and he was kind of and, he'd say he loved the script. He said it was kind of like David Lynch and all this. And then, one day, Dennis, running on the Chuck Palahniuk website, he knew somebody that ran one of, the David Lynch fan sites. And that guy contacts him and goes, hey, congratulations. That film, that script that you have that you're trying to get made, David Lynch is making it? That's pretty cool. And we're like, wait, what are you talking about? And, check online, and he links us to some stories, and there's some stories, and they're all in Portuguese, and we got to translate them, and they're from down in Brazil, and this guy went back home to his home country, and I guess they were how's everything in the States? How's it going trying to be an actor? And so he meets with some local press down there, and he tells them all these stories, and it's going great, and then he's just got cast in the new David Lynch movie. And of course, there is no new David Lynch movie, so he uses the whole plot of our script and the title of our script, and he claims that it's got Matt Damon and Kirsten Dunst and all these people in it. It went really far. I mean, we had to talk with some David Lynch's people. And when David Lynch was, when his website was answering questions in that little booth with the microphone and blast him about it. And he was like, I never heard of it, so it was this whole thing, and it was this huge headache, one good thing came out of it. If you go back and find this guy's articles and you read them and you translate them, he claims that when he went on the audition for David Lynch, he walked into a room and it was a dark room, and then just a spotlight came on. And David Lynch held a spotlight in his face for 3 hours, and he stood and no words were said, and he stood his ground and he stared into that spotlight and after 3 hours, David Lynch slowed the spotlight and said, "You've got the part." And that was and that was the way the whole thing went down. And we got to take something out of this headache. And we were like, well, we know as a fact from reading interviews and stuff that David Lynch doesn't even hold auditions, so that really never happened. And we were like, well, he stole the whole plot of our script and talk to the media about it. So we're going to take his little story of how David Lynch auditions. We're going to stick that in the movie.
Nice.
And so, yeah, that was the one thing. But, other stuff, the friends at the party. I mean, we all know people like that. Yeah. None of the actual things are, specific.
Right, right. Like,
I think it was really – I think from that aspect, it was just really well written. And the actors did portray those characters really well to the point of where it did feel – it felt like we know those people, we know those friends, we've had those friends. And I think a great deal of that pulled over. So, I love that realism to kind of the batshit craziness that we're about to hit. I thought, and it was balanced well too. It didn't, like, the movie doesn't take a fucking nosedive into, you know, Crazy Town, but I don't really ever like to say Crazy Town. But there's a band called Crazy Town.
Yeah, good fucking band, yeah.
Right? It's not like Butterfly.
What's that guy's name again? The guy who's on, like, he was on like Rehab, the Rehab show.
Oh god, it's the worst.
Oh man!
Whoa, Shifty Shells. Now I remember that.
Shifty, that's it. Yeah, Shifty.
That's amazing. Shifty.
Oh, well, anyways, total derailment. No, I mean, I love that realism again. I can't stress that enough with this film, because you don't get that a lot in horror. You know, you're sitting there waiting, but you kind of really connect, especially with the lead. You just really connect with those people and her struggling before she, you know, dives into this world of just fucking batshit craziness that's gonna happen. So
yeah, I think even like we talked about with the humor earlier, where we said, like, yeah, we're not like playing it for jokes, but like there is humor there, but it's kind of like grounded in reality, to where like it's situations that we actually see in real, yeah, you see in real life, and you kind of like laugh to yourself going, like, you know, like, really, is it, you know, like, so it's just kind of like, I think everything, like, you know, whether it be humor or horror, I think like having like it grounded in reality, I don't know. For me, it connects me more to a movie. I mean, like, a lot of times when I watch something, like, if it's horror, if it has, like, all the genre tropes where, like, everything from the cinematography to the score to the way people are performing is really just horror movie. Like, I just can't attach myself to it because it just feels like it's this completely fabricated world. You know, like, I need some sort of, like, reality to ground myself in. And then, of course, it is a horror movie. It is going to get, as you keep saying, batshit crazy. But, like, you know, like, in order to, like, for me to go into that place, I kind of need to first have connected with, like, characters and themes and whatnot. You know,
yeah,
like,
it's layered really well. And, you know, when she starts to kind of get sick and feel sick, and there's that scene with her in the apartment, I was just like, get this girl a shower, get something, get her to a doctor. You know, it's just, do so. I really felt for the character in that moment. It's like, and it's like, why aren't her friends taking her to a doctor or whatever? You know, why is this? But you really, I don't know. I got so caught up, you know, once things start going that direction, that you really, you know, Alex Esso does such a great job where you really connect with her there, and I don't know, it's just really well done, you know. So. But yeah,
you bet. Thank you.
Guess I get the girl some Bactine or something. Get some Band-Aids. We need something.
Yeah,
some peroxide. Put some peroxide on that, please.
Yeah, that would have solved it. That's actually what we were trying to get at the movie. If friends just gave her some peroxide, like, you
know? Everything would be fixed. That cures all.
No, there's more layers to that. I don't want to go in any further. You know, there's just so many layers on how people are who are ambitious, where they don't see their own, how their ambition is affecting other people. And that comes across really well with those scenes as she starts, you know, moving that direction. And it's just fantastic. There's just so many layers to it. It's great. And it's one of those things that would lend itself to more of a spoilery conversation, but we really want our listeners to check it out. And, you know, I don't want to spoil anything.
Cool. Thank you.
Brad, did you have anything else, good sir?
Well, aside from your Western that Travis Stevens is producing, well, what else are you guys doing?
we just did a segment of an upcoming anthology called like a horror anthology called Holidays that XYZ Films is doing. It's cool. Kevin Smith is doing one. Gary Shore, Nick McCarthy, who did The Pact, is doing one. Sarah Dina Smith, who did a really great movie called Midnight Swim, is doing one. So there's really interesting filmmakers involved in it. And the premise is just everybody's doing a different national holiday. You know, so we did Valentine's Day. I think Kevin Smith is doing Christmas or Halloween, maybe. And everybody's doing a different holiday. And I don't know when that's coming out. Maybe the fall. But we're editing that right now. Pretty happy with it. And then we're just going on a lot of meetings trying to kind of get our next feature film kind of locked up. Nothing we can talk about yet, but hopefully we can, you know, have an announcement to make about what we're working on next. We hope to be directing something again by the end of the year, so hopefully soon.
Well, now there's planes.
Yeah,
there's like a B-52 flying over mine.
How about you, Travis? I know you're starting to ramp up more into you know, we're still here. We are still here. Just got done playing at South by Southwest.
Yeah, I'm just doing Netflix TV marathons. That's my goal for next year.
Nice.
I mean, donuts?
Just eating donuts. Eating donuts and just catching up on Archer. No, what do we got? We just launched Tay Gagan's We Are Still Here, which is a sort of a 1979 haunted house movie.
Cool.
That's doing the festival circuit now, and I believe will be out this summer in the States. So stay tuned for that. In post-production on a movie from John Carchietta called Teenage Cocktail that will do a – it's about two young ladies who begin a relationship that's sort of gets them to do some questionable things and things spin out of control. And then editing a skateboard documentary right now that we produce called Concrete for Churro.
Cool.
Which, you know, last year went down to Mexico a bunch to sort of document the blossoming skateboard scene down there and sort of how it impacts the local economy and sort of culture and the future of Mexico. And what? This month I'm shooting a segment of Karin Kusama, a horror anthology called XX, which so she's just – I've just been a monster fan of hers. Actually, the first job I had in the industry, I really, really pushed hard to have the company make Girl Fight, and it didn't happen. And since then, I've always been like, oh, I want to work with her. And it's like, oh, my God, now here's a chance.
Cool.
And then, just developing scripts. I mean, just – you know, we're just on a roll right now, so it's
nice.
Yeah, you know, but I assume at some point it's going to, you know, switch full time over to figuring out how many horses Dennis and Kevin can afford.
Yeah, I'm excited about the XX thing because it's a big it's a big thing for the women in horror, and especially for Karin, because I just came off of, you know, the Invitation at South By, and I was blown away. That was my number one for the fest, and I'm just excited to see what all those ladies can bring to the screen. That's going to be something.
I mean, it's really funny, and there had been this sort of I think Twitch wrote the first one, but just sort of an article on, you know, hey, where are all the female filmmakers in horror? So it gets more attention for it, but coincidentally, last year there happened to be a bunch of sort of interesting films from you know, female filmmakers, and it's like it's a weird thing where it's like, do you need to actively support it, or can the art itself sort of, you know, draw attention to you know, the fact that they happen to be female filmmakers. And it's just crazy. So like Dennis mentioned, Sarah Dina Smith and Karin Kusama and there's all these people who are sort of doing interesting movies right now. And I think they're maybe getting the opportunity to, because whenever you're doing indie genre stuff, what are you really looking for? It's something fresh, and it's a fresh voice. And I think with a lot of these filmmakers, they're coming with material that you haven't seen before. You know, it's from a slightly different perspective. And that's what's exciting about it. So it's this weird thing where I don't know if it was because people sort of noticed, hey, we need more of this, or if just it was a coincidence. But now it really feels like there is this sort of wave of awesome genre films from a female perspective. And I just feel lucky because I think this year I'm working with four female filmmakers, and it's just cool to be a part of it.
Awesome.
You know, that way.
Like last year, showing Starry Eyes around the festival circuit, a lot of like the best films I was seeing at the festivals, like Honeymoon, The Babadook, and like Midnight Swim and stuff, they're all like these female-directed genre films that are just really good. And it's good to see them out there.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, guys, I want to thank you guys for coming on. Travis, Kevin and Dennis, you know, thanks for
and me,
Brad. Shut up. thanks guys for spending some time with us talking about Starry Eyes. It's one of those films I'm glad is out there, and I can't wait to. It's one of those things I definitely will be recommended to people when they whenever they ask me, you know, Sean, let us know some fucked up horror movie you want to watch or we should watch. I'm definitely I'll recommend Star Eyes, but like I said, I think why people are gravitating to it is because it's more than just a horror flick. There's so much, so many underlying themes that it's something that, you know, is a really fun conversation piece, you know, to have after watching the film. So thank you guys for that, for giving us
Thank you. And I encourage all of your listeners to also recommend it to their friends because nothing makes you look cooler than somebody watching Starry Eyes after you recommend it.
Yes.
And it's a guaranteed way to get laid.
There you go. There you go. All right, guys. Thanks again. Well, when that Western comes around, we'll be talking again soon because you need to inject a little bit of horror and then we can, you know, have an excuse to talk to you.
Very cool.
There it is.
Yeah, it's a horror Western for sure.
There you go. All right,
guys. Great talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Have a good day.
Yep, you too. All right, Brad, it's time for our pick of the week. Since you started with the What's at Your Doorstep segment, I'll go ahead and start on the pick of the week. One of the reasons I jumped into Region Free was because I wanted to own the Blu-ray of The Stuff. And this was an Arrow release. So, you know, the Larry Cohen movie.
We know what The Stuff is.
I know. You know what The Stuff is.
It's eating you.
Just a fantastic, weird little film. And it only has a DVD release over here, so I bought – Arrow had a sale. And
yeah, but the DVD is a bootleg by Top 10, though.
Really?
Top 10 was a bootleg company.
Oh, God.
They did VHS transfers. I owned them all because they sold them at Kmart. When I was younger and lived at home, Kmart was right down the street, and they had a little end cap with all the new Top 10 stuff, so I picked up everything there. But they're all bootlegs, yeah.
Well, I think I had the Image DVD though. Image Entertainment put out a DVD.
Oh, well, there we go. That's another shitty company that
it was not a good transfer at all. Just horrible. So when I heard there was a Blu-ray of it, I was like, "Oh my gosh, I got to get this." And then I heard it was a region locked Arrow Blu-ray. So this was the movie I bought that we had. There's a sale and I bought it. I think even before I had a region free player. And when I got my region free player, it was one of the first ones that I popped in, and it looks fantastic. And there's just some great special features on it. So that's all I got to say about the movie. I mean, we've all seen this stuff pretty much. If you haven't, get on it right away. If you only own the DVD and you're needing a region to go to a region free player, this is a good reason to go to. I mean, there's tons of reasons why you should be region free.
Yeah, there's better reasons.
And I wanted to take a moment here because there's a I'm trying to find this thing. There's a Sears brand called Seiko. Have you heard of this Blu-ray player?
I'm just gonna say right now, from your history of Blu-ray players and me telling you what to get, I am not endorsing anything you say.
Well, this was from one of the horror movie groups. A couple of them posted this. They had this player on sale for like down to $39.99, and a lot of people, I think it's a Kmart brand one too, and a lot of people kind of swear by this. So I'm just relaying information that I've heard. If you want to jump in region free for cheap, this brand from Kmart or Sears called Seiki, S-E-I-K-I.
That sounds awful.
It's one of the only Blu-ray players. You enter in a code on the remote, and then a secret menu pops up, and you can just change the region right there. And I don't know why no one's cracked down on this, because, you know, companies can't do that, you know.
Well, they're mods, yeah.
But so you have to get it modded from, like, 220 Electronics, which that, for a legit way to go, I would say spend, like, $130, go through 220 Electronics, and grab one of their players. But if you're wanted to jump in, you don't have a lot of money, a lot of people say, I don't have the money, I don't have $130 to spend, this is a cheap way to jump in for, you know, like I said, on sale, $39.99. So you can get region free for about $50, I actually ordered one because it was so cheap to test it out. So I will be testing this out, and I'll let you guys know because I need one for the other room anyway. Because the one that I bought through eBay is a piece of crap, so I have nothing to lose. So I'll let you guys know. But I think the price jumped up anyway by the time you guys hear this. But I'm saying this brand, if there's something you want to give it a try, give it a shot. At least try it, and then you can always return stuff within 30 days. So it's a cheap way to give it a shot, and if it's a piece of shit, then return the thing. So anyway, but I wanted to see if you had heard about this brand. A lot of people have.
Nope.
No? Okay. But it's the only one you can punch in a remote code and you can unlock it. So I don't know.
Mine's super easy. You turn it on by hitting 1, 2, or 3.
Yeah, that's how mine is.
Surgeon code, and you turn it on that way, and you don't have to do anything else. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And it's super silent.
But you know, every time I tell people to go region free, you always hear people complaining that they don't have the money to do it. So I'm just trying to offer a
budgetary. After they buy the Halloween limited edition box set. Yeah, stop buying Blu-rays for a week. There you go. That's how you buy.
Yeah, dude. I mean, even $130 for a Blu-ray player, man. That's not a lot.
But I think I even got mine for like $80 on 220 Electronics during Black Friday.
Yeah. Yep. So there's
mine
ways
for a few years now.
There's ways to go region free, and believe me, you will be happy you did. A lot of people holding out. I held out for a while, but believe me. If you're a fan,
I don't understand why people don't do it.
You just do it. I mean, it's ridiculous with all these different, you know, certain movies come out. Like, why hasn't the U.S. had a Blu-ray release of the stuff? I don't know, but there's one in the U.K.
Because the fucking rights, man. You know this. Image is like, give them. Let's do VHS transfer.
God. Them and freaking Lionsgate, man. Lionsgate's holding out so much shit. All right. Anyway, what's your pick of the week, man?
I created Pick of the Week so I can talk about some of my favorite movies that are older. So that's the reason why I created this segment, and that's what I keep doing.
What did I just do? I just talked about an older movie.
No, you're fine. You're fine. I'm saying
punk?
Myself.
No, I'm just kidding. Cool, man.
So aside from plugging Raiders of Atlantis again and Asylum Blackout, I'm very partial to this movie. It is obviously, you'll see it every time you're at Walmart, every time you're at a video store, you'll see it in the used bin, and you'll glance at it, and you're like, no. Because it looks awful on the front. It's called The Breed. It's got Michelle Rodriguez in it, and it's just a woman bending down like in front of a ferocious dog.
Do you know how many times I've grabbed that movie and looked at it and put it back?
It is one of the best, like, silly horror. I mean, it's not even silly. It's Night of the Living Dead with dogs. That's exactly what it is. Huh. A bunch of people go on a trip, and there's a pack of wild dogs that are out there, and they just attack them. But there's like, I don't think there's any CGI in this movie, but the animal training and what they did for this movie is amazing because it looks like they're fucking killing these dogs. Like, there's a sequence where, like, one of the ones is running upstairs, and the guy, like, comes through a window and kicks the dog off the stairs, and the dog flies, lands on the table, and gets up and starts running again. And it's like, wait, did you literally just kick that puppy? I don't know how they did some of this stuff, but, I mean, there's an on-set documentary about how they did it and how careful they were with these dogs. So the dogs are super sweet. But man, it's like they pull it off so well. But it's an action-packed movie. I like animals, animal attack movies when they're done with real animals and, you know, animals that are real rather than creatures and shit like that. Just because it feels real and animals are unpredictable.
Yeah.
So I enjoy that. And this is one of them. Like I said, it's the best way to describe it is Night of Living Dead with dogs. And, dude, it is so fucking good. I picked it up. Like, I watched it on Netflix years ago. And, you know, I couldn't believe that this movie wasn't. And even still to this day, people don't talk about it.
No, because it looks horrible. You see the cover and you're like, oh, that looks horrible.
It's so easy to pass. You're like, oh, yeah. Michelle Rodriguez, Tara Manning, you know. It's totally worth it. It's a very, very fun movie.
You can get it used for like after shipping for like $5 on Amazon right now, Blu-ray. So
yeah, it's always cheap. It's always in the bargain bin, and it's something I never understood because it's legitimately like a really good movie. Like for a horror animal attack thing, like this is one of the better ones. So
cool.
But yeah, that's always been a favorite of mine.
Cool, man. I just bought it for $6.24 after taxes and all that crap.
Yeah, you won't be disappointed.
It'll be fun. I will report back. Let you guys know my take on the breed.
Hey, you didn't like Death Ring, so there's no
dude. Death Ring was fun, man. Death Ring was fun. I had a blast.
All my
with Death
picks
Ring.
Of the week are movies that I cherish. Just to let everybody know,
you can but movies, you know,
movies that are very important and have changed me and wanted me to be a better writer and stuff like that. No, I'm not saying like that's like. I don't even think Death Ring was pick of the week, was it? Was it a pick of the week?
We mentioned it at some point. No, we were talking about another flick and we mentioned it.
Yeah.
I mean, dude, I own the movie Pathfinder on Blu-ray, and that's a horrible movie, but I friggin'...
My cast is over.
I can never get myself to sell it, and I have a lot of fun with that movie. And I hope the... there's movies that, you know... I consider like not the greatest movies, but I like them and I have fun with them. You know, everyone approaches movies differently, but I can like a movie and also realize its faults too. You know, so
yeah. Well, I just like
dude, I bought freaking Blue Crush. Okay.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, come on. I love it. So
you can have Blue Crush. I like Bring It On. That's one of my. That's my.
Nice.
So but no, like specifically with. With like stuff like The Breed, it's fun to watch. It shows you how to build up intensity, and you know it's very much like Joe Don Baker's even The Pack, where his family's out and about and their family gets attacked by dogs. Hmm. It's kind of the same thing, you know, where you utilize a sound like I was. Like grasping for air right there.
yeah.
But anyways, you utilize like these animals and you create this atmosphere to where like you don't even have to have them do anything. You can just have animals show up because we know how vicious these, you know, dogs can be. It's the same thing as a Draft House Films is putting out Roar, you know, It's being in the room with the animals without the animals doing anything, fear already sets in, you know? So I think making that and turning that, molding that into an action movie or a horror film, you have to do it very carefully, but at the same time, you can make people lose their minds almost in these movies. It's the same thing as like, you know, we mentioned, the crocodile, films, you know, like Rogue, Blackwater. The reason why I like Blackwater more is because the crocodile is more real. Like, it doesn't do crazy fucking things and, you know, all that shit. Like, there's that one sequence where they're just walking through the water and they stop and the crocodile raises right up in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is one of the most terrifying moments in movies. And nothing even happens.
Yeah.
It's just because that I could totally like when you can see it happening and you know exactly in your situation that's what would happen. I think that's more terrifying than, you know, a killer that's stalking people or, you know, aliens from outer space. I don't know, it's that realism that they pull, and I think The Breed does that very well.
Cool, man. I'm actually seriously really excited to watch The Breed. So.
Yeah. So.
Good time. Cool, man. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. Again, Starry Eyes is on Netflix Instant now, so you have no excuse, everybody. Like I said earlier, check it out. It's, as you heard from our discussion about it, it's really a standout film, and you should really check it out. We want to thank oneofus.net, of course, for posting our show, and also nerdly.co.uk for posting our show over there. We really appreciate the support from these guys, and really, like, seriously, they have brought in a whole lot of you guys listening to the show, and it's great that they've helped us out that way. Like I said, the coffee shop, if you go to coffeeshopofhorrors.com and put in Screamcast as the coupon code on checkout, you get a 10% discount, which is fantastic. And we also have on our website at thescreamcast.com in the shop page, We have some of our older t-shirts available, and we have new shirts available, new designs from kind of an order on demand type site. And you can grab some shirts there if you want. And we have mugs if you want to sip your coffee and look at our logo, which is a damn good logo, man. Kevin Spencer is killing it. Check out Kevin Spencer's artwork at inkspatters.com. All right, well, that's going to do it for this week's show. We want to thank all of you guys for listening.
Wait, what about my plug?
What?
What about my plugs?
Plug it.
Go see It Follows.
Mm-hmm.
Again, still, because it's going down. It's only like down to two showings in town. So it's not doing as well as other movies, but it did kill it. Like Radius, Tim League, great write-up. It was funny because he called Faraci out, because I'm not a big fan of Devin Faraci. Yeah, but he basically said, you're wrong. It was successful. It's Radius's biggest movie so far.
Yeah, totally. Yep.
So just because it didn't make, you know, $50 million doesn't mean it's not success, because, dude, that movie probably didn't even cost $1 million to make.
Yeah, got
to
look at the budget. And
they also didn't promote it. Like, you know, that's the other thing is they didn't, you know, like, I remember You're Next. I remember them saying they spent millions of dollars on their promotional stuff because it was everywhere.
Yeah.
They didn't really promote It Follows, but I think that worked out, that word of mouth. So I'm one to say that criticism and critics, it doesn't really help all that much. To me, writing a review and having one person watch the movie, I am a success. The same thing as with this show. If you watch one of the movies we tell you about, this show's a success. That's what I believe, because it's all about promotion and helping movies. I don't give a fuck about myself. But I think critics really did help with It Follows, like word of mouth on that one, playing at festivals. So great job on everybody's part, and definitely go see it. Support indie horror 100%.
Cool.
And also non-horror, which I should have mentioned, I picked up the 30th anniversary of The Breakfast Club.
Oh,
the full case can. Oh, it's beautiful. It's the best it's ever looked.
Nice.
It's absolutely gorgeous, and I highly, highly want people to pick that up, because I bought that movie 100 times, and so can you. But this is probably the best it will ever look, and there won't be another one unless they go into the vault and get like that additional hour and a half that John Hughes cut from the movie.
Oh, jeez.
So
cool, man. And also, hey, this week when you guys are buying stuff, when you get stuff on your doorstep,
snap
a picture
just so we can see. Because, dude, I guarantee you somebody's going to show us something we didn't know about.
Yeah. Hashtag what's on your doorstep. And I'm excited. Anything,
like, new or old, doesn't matter.
Yeah, whatever you get, if you want to share it, hashtag what's on your doorstep. We will retweet that shit. All right, everybody. All of you guys have a great week. We will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye, Sean. Bye, everybody.
Oh, don't tell me you're leaving. The party's just begun.